Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Saving Michael, How Rescuing a Throwaway Child Turned Me into a Foster Care Advocate, by Carrie Vellis, narrated by Carlotta Brenton. 1. Our Choices, Our Challenges. On a warm, sunny afternoon in February 2013, I looked out my kitchen window and saw the flowers in my garden waving in the light breeze. On that particular day, though, my beautiful backyard wasn't what grabbed my attention as I stood at the window, nor did I notice the huge stack of plates and bowls piled in the sink in front of me. Instead, I stared at the row of plastic bottles of drugs taking up half my windowsill. We had pills for depression, anxiety, ADD and ADHD, and anti-seizure meds and rectal diazepam for seizure recovery. This row of medications was, and still is, as much a part of my everyday life as my yard full of flowers and the dirty dishes in the sink. Even now, I have to laugh out loud when I stare at this row of bottles and ask myself again how this happened. Years ago, I'd never have imagined anything close to this in my life. But these medications are lined up on the windowsill today and will be there tomorrow and the next day. My life changed forever when my husband, Teddy, and I became foster parents and opened our door to children in need of shelter and care. If only it were that simple. To shelter and care for a child. That's the language used to describe fostering. But we knew almost nothing about the world we were stepping into. Shelter and care represent the superficial description, but what I'm about to share with you is the hardcore version. I'm taking the lid off foster care and describing situations in which the system of providing shelter and care works as designed, but also, equally important, when it doesn't. Back in 2013, I didn't yet comprehend the reality of fostering, and later the process of adopting through the foster care system. Like everyone else, I understood the basic concept of vulnerable kids needing protection and stand-in parents. But the idea of stand-in parents means many things. Individual situations vary greatly. However, the harsh reality is that most of the children in need of this shelter and care have experienced serious neglect and/or abuse. Today, I know the majority of foster kids have been pushed aside and hurt physically and emotionally. As I recently told a friend, it's not a question of if they've been abused or neglected, but only of how bad it was for them. I've reduced the issues of abuse and neglect to a matter of degree. In more cases than I care to count, it's a miracle these children are even alive. Before I started fostering, it never occurred to me that one day I'd rush to my phone and call 911 as one of my foster kids had a grand mal seizure, fell to the floor, and stopped breathing, while all my other children looked on. I never thought I'd be up every 2 hours to focus 100% of my attention on a heart monitor hooked to an infant withdrawing from heroin. Some situations proved to be not only surprising, but also shocking, like a child screaming in ungodly emotional pain for 9 hours straight, or even longer on more than one or two or three occasions. These screaming episodes went on over a period of time measured not in weeks or months, but in years. Really? That could never happen. Not in my house. Or so I assumed. I didn't know anything about the kind of trauma that would lead to this endless screaming, let alone how I would cope with it for years. That's only a sample of the events that tested my faith and shook the foundation of my life, and my family's life as well. I wasn't completely naive. Like everyone else, I knew about child abuse and had generalized impressions of what that term meant. That was a start. But these years have taught me more and changed me in significant ways. These past years softened my heart, but toughened my spirit and resolve. Trauma, neglect, habitual child abuse are not abstractions for me. Not after holding beautiful little toddlers and preschool-aged children in my lap and listening to them disclose the horrible stories of what had been done to them. I'm not even going to describe some of what these children talked about. On the other hand, I'll say this. By the time I heard my 2.5-year-old talk about his birth mom trying to drown him on one occasion and strangle him on another, I was already beyond shock. Just as I never thought I'd hear, firsthand, these kinds of stories, I also started this journey not knowing how fiercely I'd end up fighting for these children. I'm still fighting today. Telling you about these kids and being honest about my story is a necessary part of the path I'm walking today. Still, every now and then, the contrast between the reality of my life now and my old world blows my mind. In a conversation with one of the many professionals we work with, I admitted that it's nearly impossible to describe the difference. I might as well have fallen through a portal into a parallel universe where no one spoke my language, I said. Even worse, in my new world, the hideous things I saw and heard often barely raised an eyebrow. Just to be clear, no one forced me to that portal. Though unprepared for what I found, I searched for the portal and worked really hard to be allowed entry into this universe of foster care. My family and I are in our 9th year of fostering, and although still capable of being shocked and horrified, I refuse to become jaded. The value of shock. Shock is good. It has the power to jolt people like me into action. If I ever reach a point at which I'm not shocked by malnourished, underdeveloped toddlers with cavities in every tooth, then maybe I should leave this work behind. If a child talks about sexual abuse occurring in locked rooms and I'm not shocked, and queasy and squelching my rage, then it will be time to look for a new passion. With the shock comes the heartbreak. I can say it out loud. My heart is broken. I'm painfully aware of the really hard journey these kids have been forced to take. My heart breaks for their scarred minds and bodies. No matter what happens going forward, they'll carry heavy baggage forever. But since I'm not jaded, I won't take in stride this massive injustice so many children face. In fact, I regularly confront an unfortunate number of professionals with the question, "Why aren't you shocked?" The question applies to everyone. Why do we so easily and comfortably absorb the notion that millions of kids carry the weight of extreme trauma and neglect? On a regular basis, I find myself caught between advocating for the children in my care and navigating the rules of this new universe. Although it was by no means the norm, it's true I've dealt with individuals, professionals, who suggest that maybe I'm a little too involved, a little too vigilant about the children getting what they need. Maybe I'm the issue. "He's so cute and sweet," one of my least favorite social workers said. "Why would he need therapy?" "Because his emotional pain is so great, he screams for hours and punches himself in the stomach and pulls at his eyes until the skin around them is red and raw," I explained once again. "So, are you seeing someone to help you?" In other words, maybe I need therapy. In the case of the previous exchange, the message behind the words is minimization of the challenges many foster children face. At times, I've given those who talk this way the benefit of the doubt. After all, everyone knows social workers and others working in our country's child protective services are almost always overwhelmed by underfunding and bloated caseloads. Still, although I heard these minimization messages often, I was never sucked into its supposition that things aren't as bad as they seem. The children pay the biggest price. But the foster parents also suffer the consequences of this craziness on display. I refuse not to be shocked when a caseworker and I look at the same red wound scar on a child's arm, so obviously a cigarette burn, but she shakes her head and claims it could be something else. Rather than my shock pushing me toward cynicism and the urge to walk away, however, my passion to advocate for children has only grown wider and deeper. My passion for kids is what pushed me to write my first two children's books about foster kids. My shock transformed into passion. That's the reason I'm taking you along on this trip. The Life of My Dreams. Years ago, when I was simply the mom of three, I had most everything I'd ever wanted. At the time, we lived in Santa Rosa, California, a lovely city in Sonoma County. I had married Teddy, a wonderful man who worked in law enforcement and whom I had known and loved for 13 years, and we had two girls, Emily and Maddie, ages 10 and 9 when we started fostering, and our boy George, age 5. Our circumstances made it possible for me to stay home with the kids and work part-time in the dental field. I was free to build my life around my family, just as my own mom had done. A precious sameness characterized my days. I'd drop our kids off at school in the morning and do ordinary things like fold the laundry and whip up a batch of chocolate chip cookies for an after-school treat. I was a regular volunteer room mom at my kids' schools. As a true holiday mom, I put together clever Halloween costumes and baked cupcakes for the kids to take to school on Valentine's Day. Our house glowed at Christmas. The neighborhood kids were welcome at our house, and I threw barbecues in our big backyard for other families on our street. Fast forward a few years. In a single day this past week, I dropped 6 kids off at school and took a 7th to see her biological mom at a correctional facility an hour away. Later that morning, I had to make the case that this same child shouldn't be forced to see her bio dad. An anxious 4-year-old in the first place. I wonder why. She gets sick before and after the visits and has bathroom accidents. She told me, numerous times, she didn't want to see her father, who she refers to by his first name. Later, I dropped another child at his therapist's office and took the two littlest ones to gymnastics. On the way home in the car, a child we'd had with us for only a week or so said, "My daddy locked me in the bathroom and hurt my vagina." I'd slipped through the portal and spent most of that day in the parallel universe. Only by now I'd learned the language and was familiar with its ways. If the story of that one day sounds a little crazy, that's because it was crazy. It was also such a far cry from anything I'd known as a child or ever expected to experience. I can barely find words to describe the contrast. I grew up in Novato, California, a town about 30 minutes north of San Francisco, the middle child of three. I had a sister 4 years older and a brother 6 years younger. The three of us attended a nearby Catholic school, and our mom stayed home to raise us. I often say that I was lucky enough to have a real childhood, which I define as being allowed to be a kid. I was free to ride horses and bikes and roller skate up and down the street. I had baths and clean clothes and good food. We sat around the table at mealtimes and used forks and spoons. I played with balls and puzzles or on the swings in the park. When we weren't in school, my siblings and I were outside in the neighborhood with our friends. I was sheltered from chronic anxiety and fear during these years. I never worried about my own safety or wondered if food would be on the table when mealtimes rolled around. If I had anxieties, they were about situations with tests and grades or friends. Unlike the children I fostered, I didn't experience hunger without knowing that food would soon appear. I wasn't hypervigilant, always on guard to avoid being punched or locked in an empty room alone. I've usually described my early life as a typical 1970s childhood, at least for families who weren't either very rich or very poor. My sister and I fought, a lot, But I adored my little brother and played with him constantly. Mom kept a model home and did everything for us. It seemed she lived to serve her family. My home was never without a homemade cake or pie, and no meal was ever haphazard or thrown together. I had my complaints. For one thing, I wasn't fond of school. I griped about it being mandatory to attend mass, but my complaints fell on deaf ears. Opting out was not allowed. Beyond those basics, we also were a family who didn't talk deeply about things, which isn't an especially unique characteristic. A set of guidelines for life was passed on in various ways, either directly or simply through watching the adults around us. For the most part, we didn't question the standards and the day-to-day behavior expected of us. Not much distinguished me from my friends and family, other than my tendency to stand up for what I thought was right or question situations in which something felt off. I've had a lot of practice using those qualities these last few years. I also learned early on that curiosity was one thing, generally a good trait, but asking questions about certain subjects out loud wasn't necessarily welcome. I once asked why a woman whose husband abandoned her to raise 4 kids alone wasn't allowed to take communion only because she was divorced. Huh? That made no sense to me. Worse, it was really unfair. And like most kids, I knew all about fair and unfair. But no one was willing to talk to me about this injustice. Rules were rules. My tendency to question and challenge others not only was motivating when it came time to advocate for my children, it also ended up being part of what drove me to get involved with protecting children in the first place. Unbeknownst to me at the time, growing up in a stable home with parents and siblings who loved me helped set the stage for this life of providing care and shelter, and accepting a kitchen windowsill filled with containers of medication for my kids. Perhaps above all else, it gave me the faith and the backbone to pursue and persist when I saw a need and tried to fill it. Naturally, people wonder why I ended up spending so much of my life in a world that is different from the one I was raised in. I never do an interview in which I'm not asked how and why I became a foster mom, and beyond that, an advocate for children. Indeed, I can name a moment when this path appeared. A tragedy changed everything. In December 2007, when George, our third child, was 2 months old, my husband, Teddy, called to tell me about an incident that resulted in the death of a baby. Teddy's entire career has been in law enforcement, and he was extremely upset that night about this senseless death. He was struggling to keep it together as he related what had happened, but at the same time, his voice was hollow, numb, not like his normal voice at all. Later that night, as I was rocking George, I looked up and saw Teddy watching us. Tears rolled down his cheeks. He came to me and lifted George from my arms and held him close. Sobbing and torn up in a way I'd never seen before, Teddy cradled George against his chest and rocked him to sleep. I didn't know the full story yet, but my husband was heartbroken. I didn't want to push Teddy to talk about what happened, but I also wanted to support him through what was obviously a heart-shattering incident. Finally, he filled in the details of being dispatched to a call, a possible drowning of a 10-month-old boy. Arriving on the scene, Teddy pulled into the driveway of an apartment complex where a crowd had gathered. Once inside, he saw an officer he knew trying to revive a naked, lifeless baby. Teddy jumped in to help, but it was too late. The baby was dead, and no one could breathe life into him again. Meanwhile, the baby's mother was yelling at her other child, a 3-year-old boy. Over and over, she yelled, "He killed his brother! He killed his brother!" What? How did a 3-year-old kill an infant? It seems the mother left the toddler in the bathtub with the baby while she went into another room and shot up. The baby drowned before the only slightly older brother knew what was happening. After listening to Teddy's story, I was broken too. Not only had a baby died, but the death was 100% senseless. "We're going to do something," I told Teddy. "We're not going to let this go. We'll find a way to make a difference." Teddy nodded. He understood me, so he was confident I wouldn't later dismiss what I'd said as simply a reaction to the intensity of the moment. That incident was the beginning of our quest to fight for kids, although at the time I wouldn't have put it that way. I might have used only the basic language about caring for kids in need of shelter. Now I realize taking care of foster kids and fighting for them every day come wrapped in the same package. Ruffling feathers and disturbing the peace. As the years went by, we and our three kids were much like other families in our community. Although I began working a couple of days per week at a dental clinic when George started school, being a mom was everything to me. I had the life of my dreams. Meanwhile, Teddy advanced in his career in law enforcement. Just before we entered the arena of fostering, I was planning art projects with the kids and taking my turn driving carpools with Sesame Street music playing for little George. We never forgot what we said the night Teddy was on the scene when the baby needlessly died. I began by researching adoption, but it was Teddy who suggested foster care. I knew foster care only as a concept and was pretty much in the dark about how the system worked. I also had concerns. Would having children in and out of our home be confusing for our three kids, even traumatic? Out of fear of exposing Emily, Maddie, and George to situations they might find tough to handle, I was a little reluctant to have an older or previously abused child come to live with us. I wasn't sure I was up for those situations myself. Finally, though, I agreed to look into foster care, and we began working with a local private agency. We attended a 3-day class I referred to as a crash course. It was designed to educate potential foster parents about the process. It also clarified the different types of foster care and the need for us to decide what category would work for us and then look to be approved in that classification. As a technical issue, it means that some potential foster parents are classified as emergency caregivers as opposed to being classified for longer-term placement. Michael and Katie and many other children came to us on an emergency basis. We picked them up as soon as they were removed from their homes, at the beginning of their cases, which have distinct stages. Once a case is opened, foster parents are then updated about the status of each stage. In the investigation stage, it's determined if criminal charges will be filed, if a reunification plan is possible, or if the child will need long-term care. Some foster parents also are approved to take a child after the emergency care has been done. By the end of a 3-month period, a child's case has moved along, and the emergency care foster parents know if the child will be ready for adoption or a longer-term reunification plan. Ultimately, the non-emergency care foster parents know more about the child's situation as a result of the investigation than the foster parents who provide emergency care. I didn't fully understand this distinction at first, which kept me mentally debating what we wanted for our family. I still had reservations about the effect of having kids coming and going from our home, especially when severe abuse was involved. Generally speaking, foster parents don't choose emergency care if adoption is their goal. This was confusing and left me teetering between the various kinds of care we wanted to take on. On the other hand, no matter what we chose, we'd need to be licensed. So we made sure to have our home study and all the other requirements taken care of. We began the licensing process by working with a local private agency, and that meant filling out stacks of forms, being fingerprinted, having a home visit, and doing many other things. Even our cars were evaluated. During the home visit, a social worker spoke to Teddy and me, together and alone, to learn about our relationship and our family. As you'd expect, the agency had a list of things to check, including things like our kids' report cards, our car registration and insurance, even our dog's vaccination records. These are the kinds of things that are probably similar across all 50 states. We were quick to prove we were responsible adults. Sometimes, though, all those details could end up seeming a little absurd in the face of the realities we dealt with. 6 months after the home study, I found myself in the bathroom on the phone with the on-call pediatrician, trying to figure out what to do in that moment when a child's intestines were coming out of his body. Later, showing a little gallows humor, I said to Teddy, "Good thing I got the kids' report cards and the dog's vaccination records from our vet in on time. They were a big help with that situation." As a matter of regulation and process, I suspect most people have no idea how much goes into checking out prospective adoptive or foster parents. As part of an overall safety check, they stuck a thermometer into our jacuzzi tub to determine the water temperature. I had to bite my tongue not to point out that we did have 3 kids and knew what we were doing. I should have clamped it shut even tighter and not made that teeny joke about burning the kids in the jacuzzi only a few times. Oops. Maybe that wasn't quite as funny as I thought when it was running through my head. I learned that lesson fast and had many more occasions to watch my mouth. Apparently, my sense of humor is not everyone's cup of tea. So, we and the cars and the dogs passed muster, and Teddy and I were fingerprinted. Of all the possible delays in our process, I never expected the glitch in our background check would be about my fingerprints. I was really dumbfounded when the person in charge of licensing suggested that something in my past might have come to light and blocked the clearance. Oh, hell, why hadn't I remembered my 1 traffic ticket? I'd been caught driving in the carpool lane when I was 17 years old. I hadn't meant to do it. It was an accident, and there wasn't even any traffic that day. Could that be the deep, dark secret of my past? A red flag. Patience is not my strong suit. I mean, I really don't like to wait. This is particularly true when I don't see a good reason for a delay. When it came to our clearance to be foster parents, however, we were told to sit tight. The clearance would come through eventually. But when? We'd already waited a long time, way too long for me. We were ready. By this time, even our 3 kids were psyched for becoming a real foster home. I decided this delay had gone on too long, and I called the Department of Justice, DOJ, myself. Yes, that DOJ, the one in Washington, D.C. It didn't take long to learn that the prints had been mistakenly routed to the department dealing with international adoption. Terrific news. The paperwork was easily corrected. This experience brought out that tiny red flag that alerted me to a bureaucratic truth. People in charge of agencies aren't always happy when clients go around them and bypass their red tape. They like their systems and may feel threatened when people invade what they consider their domains. For sure, I found those in charge were easily annoyed when anyone short-circuited their procedures. I wasn't supposed to call the DOJ myself. I ruffled a few feathers in this agency in subtle and not-so-subtle ways. It wouldn't be the last time. If at first. Regardless of delays and such, Teddy and I took the next step and began going to meetings called match viewings, a practice that struck me as odd from the start. During these sessions, a social worker was designated to help us find a child. Other prospective foster parents were there too, and we walked up and down aisles of long tables, where in the top left corner of each we'd see a tiny photo and a write-up about the child. The idea was to look at the children and pick out those who drew our interest. Whoa. I cringed. I should look at photos and decide which child I'd like to foster? I asked that question to be sure I understood. At first, I was upset, and couldn't get it out of my head that these kids were actually being placed by how they looked in a photo and were described in a brief write-up. Wouldn't it be better to meet individual children and spend time with them? But when in Rome and all that, putting my reservations aside.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?